Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the picture, what I've left behind. You once again I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know just what you have done.
Well, good evening, everyone. I would like to welcome you to the Stop Child Abuse Now talk radio show, sponsored by NASCA, which stands for the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. My name is Penelope Bennett, and I am from Bellevue, Washington. And here on my host team this evening is Tamika Chambers from Tillamook, Oregon. So we wish to welcome you this evening. It is Monday, November 15th, 2021. And tonight, our type of show is special guest night. We have a very special guest with us this evening. She is a returning NASCA family member. We have Dr. Emily Samuelson from Baltimore, Maryland, joining this evening. And before Tamika and I introduce you to Dr. Samuelson and read you a little bit of the bio that she has, to a little bit more about NASCA and its mission. Before I do that, I would highly encourage you to call in if you're interested in being a part of the show and joining our panel this evening. All you have to do is dial in to area code 646-595-2118. Again, that number is area code 646-595-2118. And Tamika will meet you on our back line and welcome you into the show. And as a panel member, we'll have an opportunity to interact with our special guest, Dr. Samuelson, this evening, and ask her a question or offer a comment regarding what she is sharing with us. This is her story tonight as a special guest. So please call in if you are intrigued. No experience is necessary to be a member of the panel. So I'll give you that number one more time. It's area code 646-595-2118. At NASCA, we are all about child abuse, trauma prevention, intervention, recovery. We have a single purpose at NASCA, and it's to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas and neglect, and we do so with two goals. The first goal is educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic, worldwide problem that affects everyone. And the second goal, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse, and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. To learn a little bit more about NASCA, I'd encourage you to go to our website. It's www.NASCA, which is NASCA.org. So without further ado, I'd like to talk to you a little bit about how the show is run on special guest night. So the show is 90 minutes, and the 90 minutes goes by very, very quickly. And on special guest night, we have our special guests come on, and they are welcome to share their personal story that is related to our mission, which is child abuse, trauma, prevention, intervention, recovery. And as we go through the guest story, we like to put some context around one's life and have some continuity with our other special guest nights. So we do the story chronologically through one's life. So in the first 30 minutes, the first third of the show is usually the earliest years from the earliest memories, a little bit of background and context on family of origin, location, who, you know, were members of the family, and childhood experiences and memories up to about the age of 18. We'll take a break, and we'll break to the panel. And the second segment is around age 18 through 30, early 30s. The mid part of life chronologically, we'll break again to the panel a second time, so our panel members will have two opportunities to interact with Dr. Samuelson, with Emily. And then we'll go to the third segment, which is the last third of the show, to talk about healing journey and books she's written, some of the work she's done, and what she's doing in her present life and what future plans that she has. So that is how the show is laid out, and it usually works very, very well to have it done in a chronological manner. These shows are archived, and they are used as tools with many, many people from around the world listen to these archived shows. It helps so many people to learn, to be educated about child abuse, and to also assist in the healing process. So we are very, very thankful to have these shows archived, and thankful for those who have the courage to come and share those stories with us. So I'd like to introduce you to our special guest tonight by reading some of her bio. As I mentioned, it's Dr. Emily Samuelson. She's from Baltimore, Maryland. She's a PhD in psychology. As I mentioned, she is a returning NASCA family member, and she's the director of the Soaring Project. So as a psychologist, Dr. Samuelson specializes in treating trauma, but she has a personal story as she's also a survivor of incest in her childhood. And she has written a book about her experience. It is entitled Soaring Above the Ashes, Thriving After Childhood Sexually, Thriving Through Childhood Sexual Abuse. Emily was sexually abused as a child. And I'm going to stop there because this is Emily's story. And I'm going to unmute her mic and welcome you on, Emily. So I unmuted your mic, and Tamika and I just wish to welcome you and thank you for joining us this evening.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Oh, well, it's a privilege for us to have you. And I wanted to read your entire bio, but I always feel like, there's just so much for you to share with us. So I really don't want to give any of it away. And so, I stopped right at the beginning, and I was hoping that as we begin the first segment of the show, if you wouldn't mind just, you know, giving us some information on just from your earliest memories, but also just a little bit about, you know, where you were born, who was in your family of origin, if you had siblings, I mean, we just want to paint a picture, get a little context of you came to this world, who was in that world and what it was like.
Okay, great. Thanks. I'm happy to do that. I was the youngest of three girls. I was the baby. I grew up in Baltimore. I was born in Baltimore and grew up there. My father was an interesting guy. He had several different careers. He was a pharmacist for a while, and then he was an attorney, and then a business owner. My mother was a hostess with the mostest. She was a gourmet cook and loved to entertain. Something I never had any interest in doing, but that's another story. I'm 5 years younger than the middle sister, and 7 years younger than my oldest sister. And what I recalled as I was living it was that I had a happy childhood. I had really good friends. My parents adored me. My oldest sister was wonderful to me. She was like the best mommy figure, much better than my mother was. And spent a lot of time riding my bike and putting on plays with neighbors and running carnivals to make money for various charities. And, you know, it seemed like an ideal childhood because I didn't have any memories of what was going on with me. You know, I didn't realize, I'm not sure when I started dissociating memories of my abuse, but I remembered my childhood as pretty happy. But then there was another side to it. And especially when I got to my teenage years, I wrote very dreadful, painful, morose poetry. I was very introspective. And I had this memory of being, I don't know, I guess I was around 13 or 14. And I was saying to myself, I think I'm evil. I don't know what I did. I can't figure out why I'm evil, but I know I am. And I go through in my head, I didn't rob a bank. I didn't kill anybody. But I know I'm evil. And that would go circling around in my head. And, of course, it was, you know, many, many years later that I realized why I had that belief about myself. I was always a pretty driven student. I did well in school. I didn't get straight A's and the best grades, but I did well. I did a lot of writing, wrote a lot of poems and short stories when I was a kid, and felt that writing was something that I wanted to do throughout my whole life. And I was the one who wrote the poems for different holidays and people's birthdays and that kind of stuff. And like I said earlier, I was really the apple of my parents' eye. They both thought I was just the greatest. And when I got my memories, it was quite a shock to have that split between being adored and being defiled and abused and abandoned. So I can't say I went merrily through my childhood because, like I said, I did have those thoughts about being evil. And I was in a lot of pain. I was pretty depressed as a teenager, but I always had this other side, which was I was pretty feisty and strong. I stood up to the teachers when I thought they were being unfair. I was always doing whatever I could for the underdog. And, you know, whether that was through political action or just standing up and calling people out when they were being abusive to other people. I could never stand bullies. I'd always stand up to them. And of course, everything looks different when you see it through the prism of the truth and the whole truth, which is just so different growing up having this narrow view of oneself and my experience. And, I don't have lots and lots of memories of my childhood. I think I blocked a lot of it out. But what I did remember primarily were good times with very close friends. And that kind of kept me afloat. I liked art. I liked drawing. I was nuts about horses. I had every kind of jewelry and clothing and pictures and carved animals, carved horses that could fit in my bedroom. because I was really kind of obsessed with horses. And I rode when I could. I didn't ride for very long. I went ice skating on Saturdays. I went bowling with my friends. It was kind of a, what you call on the surface, like a typical middle-class childhood. And, I can't think of anything remarkable. Oh, although there was one thing that was very interesting. When I was in sixth grade, I wrote a story about a Mexican boy and his sister who were living in an orphanage, and they ran away and crossed the Rio Grande River, and they were then they were caught, and they ended up being sent back to the orphanage. But the person, a woman they had met during their travels, was very kind and protected them. And now she was the one who was running the orphanage. It was just such a classic running away story. But it had a happy ending. And I think in retrospect, it was because I wished that I could run away and come back. Mm-hmm. And if I had to come, have different people, different parents running the show. I did run away twice in my life for real. One was when I was a little kid, maybe seven. I don't remember why I ran away. I don't know what happened that, in the kind of world that we all knew, I don't know what happened, but I filled a pillowcase with some stuffed animals and some pretzels, and I walked across the lawns to go to a neighbor's house because she always seemed so nice. But when I got there, she said I had to go home. She called my mother, and I went home. And it was never talked about. Nobody asked me, why did you run away, or we're so glad you're home. Or it was very bizarre that there was so little attention paid to feelings in my family. So another time I ran away was when I was 16. I ran away with a girlfriend, and we went to Atlantic City, New Jersey, and didn't leave a note. It was a very nasty thing to do to parents, but we didn't think twice about it. And I think that whole theme of running away, we didn't stay away for very long. We came home and didn't get punished, didn't get yelled at. It's very bizarre. Anyway, so I think it was the idea of running away was because I was trapped. Like all kids mm-hmm. are trapped in their homes. There's no escape. And when you're being abused and you can't escape, you don't have a whole lot of options, So for mm-hmm. me, I dissociated. And I don't know when I stopped remembering the abuse. I think I remembered it all through my adolescence. I might have remembered it in childhood. But I don't, there was some time when I stopped remembering it. It might have been in my later adolescence. And it wasn't until I was 39 that I got my memories of, mm-hmm. The other side of my life that I hadn't remembered. So it was pretty devastating to get those memories. But anyway.
I'm sorry, Andrew, I'm just brimming with questions, and I'm sure Tamika has them as well. And I guess my first question is, so the memories that were obviously dissociated, this was sexual abuse in nature, correct?
Yes, yeah.
Was there physical abuse or emotional abuse as well? Were there other forms of maltreatment in the home?
No, not that I remember, but I can't be sure. I mean, I think there was never any physical abuse. I wasn't struck or spanked or smacked, that kind of thing that I remember. But I did, certainly emotional abuse. And my father was very threatening and very sadistic as I got older, because I think I tried to fight back a little more. And he got more cruel to me and threatening. And, of course, I was completely neglected by my mother, who I realized later that she knew what was going on and did nothing about it. So, I don't know what happened to her that would create a woman who didn't have like basic maternal or young. I don't know what happened to her. I don't know if she was sexually abused. I wouldn't be surprised if she had been, but, and I think my dad was pretty horrifically abused. He didn't talk about it much, but he sort of suggested that his father was very rageful. And, I think in retrospect, I think my father had DID, dissociative identity disorder, what used to be called multiple personality disorder. There's no way of knowing for sure, but that's it makes more sense to me, especially because I've worked with people who have DID, and that kind of complete split between kind of the who they are in the daytime and who they are at night, that kind of thing. My father was a really gentle guy. He was more like a social worker when he was an attorney. And when he was a pharmacist, he would tell stories of people coming in and asking him for all kinds of advice. And when he owned a business, he had people working there working at the store for 25 and 30 years. So he was kind and gentle. He spent all his free time in the garden, raising beautiful flowers and fruit trees, and just a gentle guy. So the extreme opposite made me believe that, all his rage was kind of came out in one part of him, and then another part of him was very kind and gentle and thoughtful. So in many ways, he was a really good father, ironically. I remember as a little kid riding my bike. I was really close to my bike. We were good friends. I was riding my bike. I fell off, kind of dragged my bike home, and I had blood going down my knee, and my father was the one I went to, and he sat me down in the bathroom and pulled out all the stuff to clean the wound, and he'd say, "Are you okay? I don't want to hurt you. Let me know if I hurt you," in a very gentle, nurturing way. And I always remembered that, and I had a little scar on my knee, and I used to touch the scar, and it would remind me of how protected and loved I felt by my father. Just very bizarre when you have one life and then all of a sudden the earth opens under your feet and you realize, whoa, that was not the life I lived. I mean, that was a piece of it, but there was an awful lot more to the story. So it was quite a shock for me, but it's odd because I was so adored by both of my parents. I was the little darling one with the curly hair, and I was funny and very entertaining as a kid. And again, it's the contrast of remembering myself as being beloved and then realizing that, you know, that was false. I mean, it was, isn't the life I lived. So when I was older and got my memories, I had suspected for a while that there was something. I specialized in treating trauma with kids when I started off in my practice. I did a lot of trauma work, and I worked with a lot of kids who were sexually abused, and began to think that, well, maybe that happened to me. I don't know. Who would have done it? Well, let me see. Which uncle could it have been? Which neighbor could it have been? You know, I know it wasn't my father, so who was it? And I mean, I was sure, you know, it couldn't have been him, so it had to be a next-door neighbor, somebody. I just didn't know, but I just had the feeling that something had happened to me. And as I said, it wasn't until a lot later that I realized that, you know, when I got my memories, it was like, oh, yes, it was Dad. It was him. So it was a winding path to get to my memories, especially because I was working with sexually abused kids. And when I started my private practice, I lived in Philadelphia for about 10 years when I was in grad school. When I started my private practice, go back a little bit. When I was in grad school, what we learned in the big textbooks of the day was that incest occurs in 1 out of 1 million families. That's what I 1 in 1 million. So when I started my private practice, my first 4 clients were incest survivors. And I thought, wait a minute. Either I won the lottery, or there's an awful lot more abuse going on than was being acknowledged by the professionals at that time. So it was quite a shock. But still, at that time, I didn't even think about anything happening to me. That sort of evolved later, when I was in my 30s. And I don't know, should I talk? Would you like to hear about how I...
I think it's a good time because we're 30 minutes in. I just would like to also open up to Tamika, my co-host, who I know has some questions for you. And then it would be then afterwards, absolutely, let's go then into your 30s, and because we'll be in the middle segment of the show, and that would be very appropriate. And I'm biting my tongue because I have about 15 more questions for you myself, but I'd like to give Tamika an opportunity to come on and just say hello, and I'm sure she has some questions for you as well. So, Tamika, I'd like to welcome you into the conversation.
Hi there. Emily, thank you so much again for being here tonight and sharing your story. I know you're going into how you realized that it was your father. My question, and maybe you're going to start talking about that in the second half of it, is that did you go to your father with the information you found out? Did you approach him? No. Did you say anything about?
He was dead.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And is there anyone else then that you address this with? Any other family members?
Yes, I did, and they thought I was psychotic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's a huge part of my story was losing my family when I came out. I know it happens to lots of us.
Absolutely.
Of course, it's devastating. At least it was devastating for me. I don't know what it's like for other people exactly, but I don't think I could have gotten my memories while my father was living. I don't think he would have allowed that to come up. It was too big. It was such a shock to my system. And and he had a really nice death. We were all there with him. He didn't suffer long. He was in the hospital for a day or two. And we all sang the songs he used to sing when we were kids. And my sister bought a tomato she had grown because he was, you know, he liked to grow flowers and vegetables. And it was a beautiful death. And then when I remembered what had happened, it was like, it kind of pissed me off that he got off so easily, you know. I mean, I'm sure he must have suffered internally his whole life, but at least on the surface, and with that, with our lovely sending him off to wherever, it's kind of funny to look back on.
And thank you for sharing it. And one of the things in regards to family, because that's something I keep hearing just out there regarding people that have experienced not only just sexual abuse as a child, but also to other types of abuse, you know, physical violence, emotional abuse. And so one of the things that people often say is that it's really devastating for family not to believe them. And it seems like it deters their healing path. They get stuck because it's like the very people that you feel like you can trust or rely on sometimes either commit the abuse or they know about it. I've heard of people telling their story that, you know, the mother was there or the father was there and knew the abuse was going on. Are they being told, like you said, you're not telling the truth. Something's wrong with you.
Right.
And so I'm hoping that either you get into it and maybe the second or third half, or if you'd like to share some of your expertise there, what would you tell people that stuck? Like you had mentioned, you know, you didn't get it until after the fact. And you had mentioned too that, you know, it would have made you frustrated, angry, you know, realizing that. What would you tell people if they are stuck between the family belief, disbelief issue that goes on?
Well, it's such a difficult road for people to travel because ultimately you have to decide if you're going to speak your truth or maintain your connections with people who don't believe you and, you know, kind of stuff it back down. And it's a horrible position to be in because, like you said, you know, you feel these really strong attachments to your family. I mean, they're your blood. And as humans, we're made to attach to people, make, you know, loving connections to people. And when they deny our reality, you know, are you going to choose them? Are you going to choose yourself? And, you know, that's, I think a lot of people go back and forth with that for a long time because it's such a huge step away from the family if you know, somebody sticks to the truth as they know it, and it's devastating. I know it was for me, and I, you know, waffled back and forth for a very long time trying to avoid going public with my abuse because I knew I would lose my family. And but, like I said, my father was dead by the time I got my memories. My mother, 6 months after my first memory, my mother was rushed to the hospital. And at that time, I had been avoiding her. She was sick. She had cancer. She had melanoma that had gone throughout her body. And I couldn't bear to be with her because I just realized, you know, that I had been abused and that she didn't protect me. So I used to go visit her with my daughter, who was, you know, a toddler, so that I could at least do the daughterly thing but not really have to engage with her. I told one of my sisters who was visiting from out of town that I was starting to get memories of being abused. And she had tremendous empathy for me. She says, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry. She was an adult ed teacher. She said, I've worked with so many women who've been through that." And then it dawned on her that I said I was abused by Dad. And she went, "Oh my God, I can't let myself believe this, or I would have to kill myself." That's what she said.
Oh my God.
She could not let herself acknowledge that I had been abused. And I realized later it's because my sisters, I believe that my sisters were both abused as well, that it went down the line at the age, down the age steps. And my sister had said that. She says, "Oh my God, I know how this happens. It goes down the family, it goes down the family line. And I can't let myself believe this." And so she didn't. And 2 days later, my mother was in the hospital dying. And she was, when I went to visit my mother, she was in and out of consciousness. And she was having a lot of trouble breathing. I sat beside her. My sisters and cousin had been with me, and they left to go to the cafeteria or something, and I was alone with my mother. And this is really bizarre, but I said to her while she's in a vegetative state, I said, "Mom, I'm beginning to have memories. I'm starting to have memories that of Dad abusing me." And this is the weird part. She sat up and said, "I know," and laid back down, and within an hour she was dead.
Oh my God.
I don't know how to make sense out of that, but that's what happened. And after it happened, I called my best friend and I told him, "My God, I said this," and she sat up, and then she went back into her vegetative state. I still don't understand it. But I know it happened because I told my friend, so I couldn't talk myself out of it afterwards because I had already shared it with someone. So very bizarre. And I didn't really grieve my mother. I grieved that I never had a good mother. And that was really painful, that I was never going to have a mom. And, my mother did all the stuff on the surface, because that was the only thing she could do, was be on the surface of things. She was kind of empty inside. So I got my emotional needs met by my oldest sister and by my dad. My mother was kind of empty, always smiling and chipper, no matter what, even though it was a lie. And anyway, so that was my, when I got my 6 months after I got my memories. It was very bizarre the way I got my memories. I was working at a school for emotionally disturbed kids. And I was the head psychologist, and I did therapy with kids, and I sort of monitored what was happening in the timeout room that they had for the kids to go to when they were losing control. And one of the kids that I worked with was in the timeout room, and he was just cursing and screaming, and so I went in there, and then he completely shut down. And so I would say all these things to try to provoke something out of him, because he wouldn't talk about what was going on. And then finally he did. That was that. And when I left the timeout room, one of the teachers there said, my God, you were so provocative with him. And I went to therapy that night, and I was so shaken by being accused of being provocative. I kept running that over and over in my head. I was provocative. And of course, she had meant I was provoking a fight. But I was hearing it as, you know, to me, provocative was sexually provocative. So I was feeling very anxious in my therapy session, and she wasn't really able to help me calm down much at all. So she suggested that I just relax and allow myself to imagine a little girl coming through the door and that the little girl would tell me what she needed, or I could ask her what she needed. So there I was, you know, in my mind, the door opened, and it was my father. And I was lying on a bed, and he walked in, pulled the covers back, and got into the bed with me. And that was as far as it went. And I knew that could not possibly be true. I knew that I was making it up. I was being dramatic. I'd worked with too many sexually abused kids and adults, and it was impossible. The back and forth that I went through of it's impossible, it's true. It couldn't be, it did happen. There's no way he could have done it. I know it happened. And I would have that the battle to come to terms with the truth was excruciating. And it's so typical of people, who, especially people who dissociate. You know, when you get your memories, it's so overwhelming. It's like the ground opening for me. It was like the ground opened up under my feet, like the earth cracked open. And I was, you know, circling down into a ravine. And I had a lot of flashbacks in the beginning. And I would be sitting and rocking and talking like a little girl and crying and saying, oh, my daddy hurt me, and walking around in a circle in my living room after my daughter was in, you know, asleep. And, of course, when I was having the flashback, I knew I wasn't making it up. But then as soon as the flashback was over, like, I just cut it back off again. And I said, well, you know, I'm just being dramatic. And I did that for a very long time. And I was in a group with other therapists who were survivors. We all did the same thing. We knew the truth, but we couldn't really grasp it and integrate it and have it be fully true. It took a long time of going back and forth. And what my therapist said to me, which I found really helpful, she said, well, how about if you believe and don't believe? And she didn't try to push me to choose one side or the other, but to hold them both, that it was impossible and it was true. And, you know, over time, I was able to embrace the truth of what had been done to me. And once I got through some pretty profound depression, although I kept functioning because nothing stops me from functioning, fortunately, you know, when I knew it was true and it was really a deeply held truth and a fact, and I didn't try to convince myself it was a lie. It created such deep rifts in my family because I decided I was going to write a book. And the book was about survivors of childhood sexual abuse who were doing well, who had worked their way through and were thriving. So I traveled around the country. It took me years to find people who would come forward, because this was in the late 90s, I guess. Yeah, in the late 90s. And back then, people did not talk about their abuse. It was pretty hush-hush. And there was so much shame around it. And nobody was talking about thriving. It was all about, you know, hanging on for dear life, you know, surviving by the, you know, with your fingernails, you know, holding on tight to the edge of the cliff or something. And I was able to find people through a tremendous amount of networking and emailing and calling different agencies and et cetera. And then was able to find people who I thought, you know, were doing well. And I went to interview them and photograph them. After I had looked for a while to find a photographer, and I'd paid a couple of photographers, I didn't like their work. And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you take the pictures? I thought, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to really work a camera. In fact, my first photo shoot, I was on the plane looking through the manual because I had just bought the camera, and I couldn't figure out how to use it. So it was really kind of crazy. But anyway, so my sisters knew that I was working on a book. I had not intended to come out in the book. I was just going to do a series of edited interviews so people would be speaking in their own voices about what happened. I wouldn't do any commentary. It would really be people just telling their stories and showing their faces. And as time went on, I started writing essays about what had happened to me or what it meant to me or what my experience was. And eventually I realized, I guess I am going to be in the book. In fact, my story is going to be woven between the other stories. And my sisters and I had sort of had this unconscious or unspoken agreement that we just weren't going to talk about my abuse. And I was desperately afraid of losing, especially my oldest sister, because I absolutely adored her. And she was of great help to me when I was raising my daughter after my divorce. And I just couldn't bear it. So I would mention it every once in a while, just to kind of inoculate her. But I hadn't told her that I was going to include my truth in the book until I mentioned something about taking a memoir class, and then she knew. And she panicked, asked me if I would go to therapy with her so she could understand why I would want to tell other people about, you know, what had happened to me. By the time we met with a therapist, she had her point of view down pat, and she didn't really want to hear what I had to say. She just kind of wanted to emotionally beat me up, basically said I was delusional, that I had made it up, that I put I put my father's head on some other man's body, that it couldn't have been my father. And she stopped talking to me. I was uninvited to Thanksgiving. And my other sister lived out of town. She wasn't talking to me either. And all the cousins gathered around my sister. And I was the outlaw, you know, I was the one who was crazy. This went on for a couple of years, and it was excruciating for me. I think what I felt, profound loneliness and aloneness that I must have felt as a child when I was being abused and I didn't have anyone to talk to about it and no one seemed to notice or care. So I really plummeted into a horrible pit, which took me a lot of work to get out of. And cousins wouldn't talk to me. And it took a couple of years. And my sister decided that she wanted to reconnect with me. And she did. And we reconnected. And then within a couple of months, she died. And then a year later, my other sister died. They were both 65. My oldest sister had lymphoma, and she died from, her immune system was shot after that. And my other sister had pancreatic cancer, but didn't know it in 4 days. You know, she got the diagnosis and 4 days later she was dead. So that was the end of my family. I was really glad I had reconciled to some degree with my oldest sister. But it was devastating when she died. It was a really painful, difficult road for me. You know, and doing my healing and losing my family and working as a therapist and raising my daughter by myself. I mean, I kind of don't know how I did it. I really don't. It was so painful and intense, but I was out there doing therapy and I raised a great kid. She's just a wonderful human being, really proud of who she is. And I just wouldn't give up. I guess that's the thing. I just wouldn't give up. I was determined to heal. And I did everything I possibly could. I was in talk therapy. I did dance therapy. I did body work. I did massage. I did acupuncture. I did herbal treatments. I did a lot of EMDR for the trauma. I did internal family systems work. Was relentless. I just was not going to give up. And I don't know where the hell that came from. I really don't. I mean, I'm lucky that I had that incredible will to heal. And there you are.
Emily, this is Penelope. And if I could just say a few remarks about, you know, what you've shared with us.
Please.
And of course, you're the psychologist. You have the doctorate with the trauma work that you do. I'm just so grateful also for your expertise because that's it's such an accomplishment and a gift to so many that need it. Again, I don't have credentials. The credentials that I have, and I'm not talking about my professional ones, those are separate. But I have very much walked, as you're telling your story, so much of it, I was nodding, it just resonated with me because my story is very, very, very similar, eerily similar to yours. So I only have experience behind me, but as you were starting your story, especially from the beginning, because you just posed the question, I don't know where I got it, but I heard this motif. I heard this motif from even early on. You have a PhD, I don't, but even in terms of you questioning as a young girl if you were good or you felt that you had an evilness about you, I feel like there's a part of consciousness that already was like, I'm going to push it forward. I'm going to bring it out, you know, I'm going to hit this head on, you know, it's like you had this relentless. You wrote the poetry. You ran away. You had this, I hear, like, every time you mention, I'm like, she's got, there it is. You know, there it is. There's the fighting spirit. There's the will to heal right there.
Yeah.
You know, you didn't remember until
right.
you were nine. You know, but I heard that.
That's true. And, God knows where that came from.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's just
anyway.
It's within you. But I felt like I heard that in your story early on. That kept resonating with me as you were talking about, you know, you went further on down the chronology of your end of your story.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were parts of it where I was wondering, as I'm, like I said, I've experienced very eerily similar things. You know, as sisters, as in the family dynamic, and Tanisha brought this up as well, in the family dynamic of those that do not wish to accept the truth, your sister, I sometimes wondered, as I was hearing from your sister's reactions, and of course drawing parallels to my own, is there sometimes anger at your strength, anger at your courage, anger at your strength to be able to face the truth head on, because it's so ugly and it's so, it's word excruciating. I completely agree. Do you, sometimes I wonder, is there anger at me for having the tenacity to say, I don't care how much it hurts. I don't care what kind of hell I have to walk through. I'm going to do this. And sometimes I just wonder, is there anger that comes in that denial?
It's interesting that you bring that up. There was a lot of anger at me, but I think the way I understand it is that they acknowledged that I was abused. They would have had to acknowledge that they were abused. And I think they absolutely could not do that. Neither one of them. And I feel so certain that they were. One sister was the perfect one, and the other was perfectly good, and the other one was perfectly bad, and acted out like crazy. And anyway, I was kind of the middle. I was in the middle of that, but I think they were angry at me for threatening them with the truth of their own experience, and so they had to kind of kill me to shut me up, and that would help them feel safer. That's the way I look at it. So I don't know that they were, I'm not sure that they were angry at me. I don't think they were angry at me for being strong. I think it was really, I was saying things that they could not bear to hear. And, you know, it's been so hard to come to terms with how they reacted, and because it had never occurred to me that they wouldn't believe me. I feel like such an idiot now when I look back on it. I was so naive. I didn't want to, at first, I didn't want to tell my sisters because I thought it would be devastating to them to find out that our beloved father had done that to me. So I couldn't bring myself to tell them. And when I told my middle sister about it, we were sitting in a car in a parking lot, and I kind of blurted it out because I didn't know when I was going to see her again because she lived out of state. And I thought, I didn't plan it. I just sort of blurted it out. And then it took a while longer to tell my other sister because I couldn't bear to hurt them. It's so ironic. I mean, my sister had really struggled a lot with, she had lymphoma, and, you know, was kind of, you know, her body was torn down by that for 20 years. And, you know, she had a tough life. And my other sister did too. So turned on me the way they did was just utter shock. Like, I'm protecting them, you know, from the truth. Mm-hmm. And then when I tell them, they attacked me. In fact, my oldest sister said, "Why didn't you tell me right away?" She said, "I think you were trying to, you told other people so you could get your story straight before you told me," as if it was a, you know, it was painful. I met with my two sisters somewhere along the way. I don't remember how far I was. They didn't believe me, but I don't remember how far along I was in my healing. And the three of us sat down to talk, and they didn't want to know. They just wanted to disprove everything I said. So it wasn't really an exchange of, you know, well, here's what happened, here's how I understand it, blah, blah, blah. And they didn't approach it with any curiosity. It's clearly they were just determined to squash me. And the irony to me of the whole thing is my sisters went on a rampage, you know, not only turning all the cousins against me, but I was on the board of a child sexual abuse advocacy organization. I was on the board, and they called and wrote to the executive director saying that I had false memories. It's so ludicrous that, you know, as if this child advocacy organization would not recognize that, you know, what happens in families when somebody blows the whistle, you know?
Right.
And then they told my aunt, who was 95, she's my mother's older sister, and I always loved her dearly, and she really was great to me. But I wasn't going to tell her. She's 95. You know, she doesn't need to know this. But my sisters told her. So when I went to visit her at Christmas, she started asking me these questions, like, "I saw your sisters, and they told me some interesting things." And she let me know what they had said. And she said to me, "Oh, Em, honey, I just can't believe that." Because she knew it was her sister's husband. And she was the only person in my family who really listened. She asked me questions. She listened to how I explained things. She listened to me talking about dissociation and how I didn't have my memories, and how what I believed about my father having a dissociative disorder. And she really listened. She was the only one. And then after we talked for a while, she said, "Oh, I just can't believe it," but in a totally different way. It's like, "Oh my God, sweetheart, I can't believe this happened to you." It wasn't like, "I don't believe that this is true." It was a total turnaround. And I cried like a baby because she was the only one in my acknowledged what had happened or believed me. And then the next day I got a message on my answering machine, and she said, "Em, honey, what do you think about writing the book anonymously?"
Oh.
It was really fun. You know, she believed me, but she didn't want me to, you know, tell the family, air the laundry or something. But it was really kind of funny. I thought, I mean, she was dear to me. She really was. She was the only one who believed me. She's 95 years old. So.
Well, but that may have been, she had that quality, and maybe that's why you had been so fond of her all those years. There was something there.
I guess. I mean, she was always kind of quirky, but she did believe me. I cried in her arms like a baby. It was so beautiful to have someone in my family say, "Yes, this did happen to you, and I'm so sorry."
Yeah.
Really something. So
Well, we know what a kickback can be when, you know, as you describe, you know, very well, what can happen and the pain of those mm-hmm. that live the same experience that should be the ones that could understand
right.
you're so closely to almost exactly how you felt it, you know, through that experience mm-hmm. that don't. I mean, to me, that's such a deep wound because, you know, your sisters and your own mother, they were there. They should, especially your sisters, they know the pain. They should, mm-hmm. You hope. They're the ones
right.
that could supposedly validate, right? They could right. understand, they could give you that empathy that because they've walked in those shoes and they don't.
Right.
That's what's so painful. Any chance of someone asks being able to give you that hug, you know, they couldn't. Not, I understand, you know, how that, I can't even barely put into words. It's almost impossible to just tell how hurtful, painful that is.
Yeah.
No, it's so close, but it's so far away.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the only thing about that. Oh, sorry.
So I just want to say, if we could finish your thought, and I do want to invite Tamika back into the conversation too.
But I didn't have anything particular to say.
Okay. Yeah. Tamika, I just wanted to invite you back into the conversation.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was me. I wanted to actually touch on the last statement that was made because I held that myth. It's you want it to be a fact. But unfortunately, and I want to say this in a way that it doesn't sound negative, but I want to say it in the truthest form, is that I realized that when I was young, I realized that family members are people too. They're human. And
mm-hmm.
unfortunately, and they have emotions, jealousy, anger, vengeance, resentment, just like anybody else. And one
right.
of the reasons why I stayed in the secret, in that dark secret, is because I kept believing they should. They should know not to do this to me. They should know how much I'm hurting. They should know this is right. And the only thing about it is that I put the power in somebody else's hand, my truth, my power in someone else's hand. And I'm glad you both brought it up, is that often that's one of the things that keep us stuck in secret, because we don't believe that someone who says or professes or have the title of parent, mother, father, brother, uncle, coach, friend, sister, brother,
mm-hmm.
that they have that title and they would do something like that.
Yeah.
But what we're breaking into is that this generational cycle of claim, what you had mentioned, that your father, you believe, suffered, Emily, abuse himself. Mm-hmm. And so, and the other very poignant fact that you brought up, too, it was like bingo. You said that if your sisters had admitted to your abuse, they would have to admit, I'm paraphrasing, of course, they would have to admit to their own abuse. And that's where it is, where we get this feedback from family members, no, that's a lie, that didn't happen, because they're
mm-hmm.
trying to protect themselves. And it's not so much about, it becomes more about, I hear you, but I need to protect me. So it's almost like they get on a defensive that I have to protect my sanity, what I believe happened, my truth, even though if it's not true, it's almost like they're in protective mode. And so there's a part of compassion, because I've done that. I was there. I have family members that have denied it, even one of the girls denied it. And she, too, the third thing that you brought up is how your sister suffered. And that's one of the things that, as a nurse, I saw that even though people would come in for physical ailments, they would discuss more of their emotional ailments, their emotional childhood abuse. and how there it becomes a destructive, internal destructive programming, I believe, inside of their body. When we talk about chronic health conditions, we're talking that anger, that jealousy, that resentment, that shame, that guilt that is somehow destroying the body's ability to maintain harmony and balance, and hence, you know, not as black and white, but then we see these rare conditions, these destructive conditions that are happening inside of people. And so it's unfortunate, though, we have family members, and yeah, they should protect us, but there's also some humanness to that, in that, and compassion, that they are suffering through pain too. And unfortunately, many often enough, we, the daughters and the that went through the abuse, we're realizing of this generational cycle of pain, nieces, nephews, and we're like, okay, wait a minute, we got to stop this. But you got some people ahead of you or before you on the side of you that are kind of like, I can't do that, because then I have to admit my own reality. And so there is some compassion. There's still that frustration and that anger, because then you feel like you are the what do they call it? The odd wheel, or the, you know, the person that, but it's like, no, I'm telling the truth. And I think that that's the biggest thing, is that we have to keep speaking our truth, that it may hurt some people, but nobody said that truth wasn't going to hurt. Nobody said
that. Right. And I agree with you 1,000,000,000% that the truth is the truth is the truth. And I decided I had to stand in my truth. I had to proclaim it, you know, and I figured, well, whenever, you know, when they die and they go over to the other side, I don't know what your spiritual beliefs are, but anyway, those are mine, that I figured, well, they'll know then, you know, they'll know the truth then, even if they can't admit it while they're on the earth. And that gave me some kind of solace in a way, that they were going to have to face it too at some point. But
I think too, the consolers, if it will and if it may be, is that you have the boldness, the audacity, the strength, the perseverance, the resiliency to stand in your truth. And I would just kind of say I commend you for that standing in your truth, even after all that you have reported, even that you've been through, even that you've shared, you know, all the stuff that you've been through, is that it takes a lot of courage to go through that and to realize who did what, people that are not supporting you. Just thank you so much for having that courage to speak your truth.
No, thank you. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I could have done it any other way. I mean, I was terrified. I mean, it took me forever to write my book, because I knew in my bones, when the book is out there, I'm losing my family. And that's basically what happened, you know, that when they knew I was going to tell my story in the book, that was then they totally cut me off. So I was so hesitant, because I was holding on to my oldest sister for dear life. I just did not want to lose her, and I knew I would, but it got to the point where I just had, you know, I couldn't, I just had to speak the truth. I had to finish my book. I'm so proud of the book. The people in it are amazing. And I thought, you know, I'm speaking my truth, and the people in the book are speaking their truth, and that's the way it is. So there, you know, if you can't deal with it, oh well. So
you talk about that loss of, you know, and I understand that loss, you know, when you speak your truth, when you, you know, are you willing to lay down your life, you know? And I know it sounds dramatic, but I think we know, if you've been down that road, that is what you do when you're willing to stand in that truth. You know, I think I found, you know, very profound when I read your bio and I read about your book, Soaring Above the Ashes, about you know, the stories of men and women in face-to-face mm-hmm. interviews, and each story has a black and white portrait of each person. That I thought mm-hmm. that was so profound, Emily, because the minute I told my story to the world, not to my therapist, not to my husband, not to my dearest friends that were there for me and were giving me that gift of listening and hearing my truth. The first mm-hmm. moment on the NASCAR show, I'm told, because you feel like there it is, it's archived, it's there for the world to hear and listen, it's there, it's documented. It's the first time I thought the day after I told my story on NASCAR to the world that I would not be able to go outside and walk in public. But I woke up the mm-hmm. next morning and the opposite was true. The first time I felt I could ever show my face and walk with confidence. And so when I read that about your book, I thought, yep. That's what you gave to so many people. You gave them that gift through your book.
Yeah. And I guess there's something about, there's something defiant about speaking the truth and standing in your truth. And it's an antidote to the shame. Like, I don't have a damn thing to be ashamed of. You know, I didn't do anything wrong. I was a victim. I'm no longer a victim, but I was one. And I didn't do anything wrong. So what do I have to be ashamed of? And it's so, mm-hmm. but of course I was, like every other survivor, I had to wrestle with my shame. And it's so toxic. But, you know, I feel very grateful that I got to the point where I could take the shame that I was, the burden of shame off my back and send it to my parents, because they're the ones who should be carrying the shame, not me.
Yeah.
But it's such a struggle to get past. It's so debilitating. And, you know, and when you speak the truth, you're doing the opposite. Like, shame tells you to be quiet, be small, keep it secret. You know, on the down low, don't let yourself shine. Just be, you know, make yourself invisible somehow so you won't be as big. And, you know, when you speak the truth, it's kind of saying, to hell with you, shame. You know, I'm not giving in to you, because it's not my shame to carry. And it's the complete opposite of shame, is to, you know, boldly speak your truth. And, but it's a hell of a journey. That's for sure.
It is. You just said something that really just resonated with me. And just for the benefit of streaming and listening, or those that are going to listen to the archived show down mm-hmm. the road in the future, can you expand a little bit or talk a little bit more, if you're okay with this, on just what you just said, giving those burdens when you speak the truth back to the people that need to carry them? You gave the truth mm-hmm. back to your father. You gave the truth back to your mother. You gave the truth. I don't know if you gave the truth back to your father, because he died before you brought the memories. You said, and then after he died, you brought the memories. But also, can you just talk about that a little bit, about giving the burdens back to those who should be owning their truth?
Yeah, well, I think once I was able to, well, I did feel angry a lot. I was going to say, once I felt, you know, the kind of pure rage about the abuse and the abandonment by my mother and my father too. You know, he abandoned his role as my parent to abuse me. He crossed that line. You know, I think some of it was the anger at them, that why am I feeling bad? You know, why am I suffering the way I suffered my whole life? You know, till suffering, not even realizing why I felt the way I did about myself. And then going through the torture of healing, which it's excruciating, at least it was for me, because I really dove deep. I really dove deep, and that's just the way I do it. And not everybody has to do it that way, but that was my way. And coming out the other side and realizing, you know, damn it, I didn't do anything wrong, and I have nothing to be ashamed of. You know, it's really, I put the shame back on them for what they did or what my mother didn't do, because I don't know, I just knew it wasn't mine. I got past the childlike, you know, the child parts of me believing that I'm bad, I must be bad, or daddy wouldn't be doing this to me. Or, you know, if I felt any pleasure, like, God, that was, you know, the most horrific thing to have to acknowledge. But I think I'd had these incredibly distorted beliefs about who I was, because that's what kids do. Kids, we're trying to make meaning out of what's going on around us. And there's no way that when I was 6 years old that I could say, well, this is simply intolerable in this home. My father is using me for his sexual pleasure and to express his aggression. My mother is, you know, emotionally empty and neglectful. I think I'm going to leave. And, gee, I wonder what kind of job I can get. You know, what kind of job can a six-year-old get? I mean, we're totally trapped. So we always think, we can't think that way. We can't realize that it doesn't say anything about us. It's we have to be self-referential because we're kids. That's what kids do. We don't have enough knowledge to recognize that, you know, I'm not a bad girl. They're bad. That's a bad mommy and a really bad daddy. It's not me being bad. But those distorted beliefs, they run so deep. And we have to believe that when we're kids. I had to believe it was my fault because I had to have the delusion that I could make it different. If I'm so bad, then if it's my fault, then surely there must be something I can do to make them love me and treat me right. So it, and of course, there wasn't a damn thing I could do. There's nothing that a kid can do. We're really, truly helpless and trapped. But I think I had the, in some ways, the illusion, not delusion, the illusion that I could have some control. If it's my fault, then I can do something differently and it won't happen. And of course, that's an illusion and a desperate attempt. I'm not sure if you're with me on this, because I don't know how clearly I'm expressing it, but you know, we have to do what we have to do to survive. And I had to believe I was bad, I was dirty, I was evil, it was my fault. I felt like I betrayed my mother because my father came to my bed, left her for me. You know, crazy stuff. I had to unlearn all that stuff. I didn't even know those beliefs were there. So the first part of the healing is, let me begin to recognize, you know, some of these beliefs I have about myself and learn that they're really distortions and try to heal them and shift them so that I'm not the bad guy. So I'm the innocent one. Out of everybody, I was the innocent one. But it, you know, it takes so much work to get there and to let go of those core beliefs that we develop as a strategy to survive.
Yeah.
You know, that's the thing. We do whatever we do when we're kids, we're doing it to survive. And, you know, thank goodness I could dissociate. I am so grateful. I'm so grateful that I had that capacity, because I got to have half a life, you know, where I thought everything was okay. And maybe I was screwed up, but it was okay. It was still okay. I couldn't handle the truth as a kid. So for me, dissociation saved my life And I'm so grateful. You know, other people who always maintain their memories, the people that I know who've done that, they have to minimize it and say, well, it wasn't that bad. I mean, it was my uncle. It's not like it was my father. It was oral sex. It's not like it was anal sex. You know, it was just the church group. It wasn't like a cult. That's what we do. We have to protect ourselves until we're old enough to try to undo the damage and let go of the ways we protected ourselves. So anyway, I just went on a little rant there.
No, but it is that evolution, you know, the dissociation mm-hmm. protected you. And you, mm-hmm. Those protections, I think, in healing have to evolve to mm-hmm. serve us well as adults. And I do understand what you're saying, because it is that evolution of actually then having to address the dissociated memory and to bring mm-hmm. it out in order to begin to protect the adult who needs to bring
right.
it out to heal. It is
mm-hmm.
a full evolution, right? And I understand that, you know,
mm-hmm.
having been there and done it myself.
Yeah.
It's hard to
yeah.
explain to someone that hasn't walked up in those shoes, but I
mm-hmm.
but it's clear as mud to me what you just said. It's clear
yeah.
as mud, so thank you.
I also do a lot of healing of all the little girls inside. You know, I had
yeah.
to bear witness to what they experienced and hold them while they were grieving or raging and help them learn that it wasn't their fault, you know, that they
yeah.
weren't bad. And, you know, that's, I think it was doing that kind of work helped me feel more knitted together inside
yeah.
because I kind of welcomed those parts back into me
yeah.
and helped me feel full. So quite a journey, huh?
Yeah, it is quite
yeah.
a journey. And thank you for sharing. I think it, because
oh, sure.
as you were, I was giving that 3-year-old little girl inside of me a big hug as you were saying those things, and you gave me an opportunity to do that, and tears actually
mm-hmm.
came to my eyes. I didn't know I needed
Aww.
To do that until you said that, and I did. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Great. Yeah.
No. Thank
wow.
you. And that's the gift that you give to so many. You know, tonight
mm-hmm.
as you're sharing,
mm-hmm.
and I just wish to thank. I wish to thank you because we only have a minute left, and so
I know.
Wish to thank
yeah.
you.
Well, thank you
and I wish
for giving me the chance to talk about it and for being so open and being such a compassionate listener. You know, that's really healing, too. So thank
well,
you.
You're very
and
welcome.
You.
Yes, you are.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Emily. And
thank
I
you, Emily.
To also thank my co-host, Tamika. And Tamika, if you want to take just a moment, we've got 30 seconds left. I know you want to thank Emily as well.
Yes, I did just say that. Thank you, Emily. And please, I know you're going to ask it if there are any final words that you have.
It's possible to heal. I guess that's it. It is possible to heal. It just takes a lot of work, but it's possible. So,
perfect.
Thank
it.
You.
Yeah, thank you both
thank
so much.
And thank you so much. I wish to thank Dr. Emily Samuelson for being our special guest this evening. I thank my co-host, Tamika Chambers, and thank you so much. This is scan number 2791. You'll be able to find it archived. And on our NASP website. So without
yeah.
to keep everyone's children safe, if you see something, please do something, say something. So thank you and good night.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.
I'll know tomorrow, 'cause that's all.